Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there. Welcome to this episode of Food Psych. I'm Christy, and today I'm talking with eating disorder psychologist Alexis Connison, who joins me to discuss her background in quote-unquote obesity research, how she came to question the conventional weight paradigm and move to a weight-neutral approach, the industry influence behind the American Medical Association's decision to classify obesity as a disease in 2013, the mental health effects of bariatric surgery, and more. I initially planned this to be an episode just for Food Psych, but then there was so much crossover with my other podcast, Rethinking Wellness, that I wanted to cross-post it there too. So this ended up being a cross-post from Rethinking Wellness, and paid subscribers to that show get to hear the full interview, where we also discuss how social media makes it hard to have those nuanced conversations, the discourse around GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic and its ilk, and the trouble with the research underlying weight loss recommendations. If you want to hear all of that, you can sign up for a paid subscription at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. This is a great conversation. I can't wait to share it with you. Real quick, before I do, I want to let you know about some resources that you might find helpful. One of which is my new book, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which you may have heard me mention here before. I co-authored it with therapists Judith Matz and Amy Pershing, who are both longtime leaders in the field of diet culture recovery, eating disorders, and trauma-informed care, who I'm really honored to work with, and who were both past guests on this podcast with fan favorite episodes about binge eating, emotional eating, and body image. And I'm really excited about this workbook because we joined forces to create a book for clinicians and general readers alike that we hope will help you break free from the diet binge or restrict rebound cycle, recognize sneaky diets disguised as wellness plans, better understand the role food plays in your life and in managing emotions, unlearn harmful messages about what and when you're supposed to eat, dispel myths about weight and health, and lots more. If any of that sounds interesting to you, you can learn more and buy the book at ChristyHarrison.com/workbook or check it out on Amazon. It's called The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which I know is a huge mouthful, but if you start searching for that term, it should fill it in. Or you can just go to ChristyHarrison.com/workbook to find it, and I have links to where to get it in the US and also internationally. I also wanted to let you know that my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, which I created to help you make peace with food, is now open for enrollment. The course teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict rebound cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and most importantly, I think, avoid turning intuitive eating into a sneaky diet. Sign up now for instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common things that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, and a live monthly Q&A to help answer all your individual questions. This cohort also includes a special members-only forum so that you can connect with others and support each other through the course, and alumni get access to future forums as well. Learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course or click the link in the show notes. And now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Alexis Connison. So tell me about your relationship with food growing up.
I, like most of us, grew up in diet culture. I grew up, you know, in a household where there was chronic dieting and binge eating going on. And I just learned from a very young age that what you did, especially as a girl, as a woman, was to try and shrink your body. So, you know, I had a lot of narratives around food and grew up very much trying to diet and thinking that if I could, you know, control what I was eating, I would be able to shift my body into something that would make me more desirable, more acceptable, more lovable. And I grew up with that narrative for so much of my life. And I really went into psychology with the idea wanting to focus on weight management and, you know, helping other people figure out what I was struggling with so much myself, which was like how to lose weight and keep it off. And it wasn't until, thankfully, I got all the way through graduate school. I was really planning for this career in weight management and quote unquote obesity research, that I started being exposed to the weight inclusivity framework. And that was really completely life-changing for me, both personally and professionally.
Do you feel like when you struggled to lose weight and stuff, was it disordered eating level? Do you feel like you ever tipped into eating disorder territory, or what did that look like?
For myself personally, I wouldn't say I ever had what I think would have been diagnosed as an eating disorder. I think I struggled with what so much of the population struggles with, which is feeling that there were certain foods that were good or bad. I was either going to be good or bad that day, stick to the diet, not stick to the diet, and, you know, would kind of go through these periods of depriving myself of certain things and then overeating and kind of, you know, going off the wagon, as I say. So I certainly never thought of it, especially when I was going through it. I never even thought of it as disordered eating. Like I said, it was so normalized, you know, first in my family growing up, it's what I grew up to know. And then it was also normalized by peers around me. Like, this was the 90s and everyone was, you know, on Atkins or trying to get six pack abs. Taped to my bedroom mirror, I had cut out pictures from magazines of women with these kind of ideal bodies that I thought I had to use for like motivation or inspiration. But it wasn't just me. All my friends had the same thing. So I really never thought of it as disordered at all. I thought it was just what people did.
Yeah. That like quote unquote normative discontent that is so common in our society and yet really does qualify as disordered eating. Like I think about those inspo pictures or whatever. And like that is something that comes up so often in people with eating disorders and all kinds of disordered eating, really. It's so normalized that it's hard to question it when you're in it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think in retrospect, you know, obviously I was not in a healthy place around food or how I was feeling about my body. And I think that it was that, like you said, that discontent, that the role that food and body played in my life that really led me into this career. So I can see in hindsight, it was certainly not healthy, but it was so normalized. And also this was a time that there was no conversation at all, at least in the mainstream spaces. And we didn't have social media. So the way that, you know, we got information was through magazines, television shows, movies, kind of the mainstream media. There was no conversation about body positivity, weight inclusivity, body acceptance. It was just kind of being bombarded with all directions about, you know, all of these really fad diet kind of stuff was just completely pervasive.
Yeah, completely. I'm curious about your decision to go into psychology. Do you feel like it was always tied up with this desire to help people with weight loss and weight management, or was there other aspects of psychology that were interesting to you and then it kind of morphed from there?
For sure. You know, there was other areas, like when I first wanted to go into psychology, it was not necessarily focused on food or eating. It was really this yearning to better understand people. And I think at the core of that, probably to better understand myself as well. You know, I just have always been fascinated with why people do certain things and kind of what goes on in the inner workings of other people's minds. And I think that probably comes from being a child who was in many ways an introvert, and I still am, and who maybe doesn't naturally really kind of get that always about other people. And it just has always been fascinating to me. And I feel really privileged to be able to do this work and to share with clients kind of on their journey, and for people to share with me kind of, you know, the inner workings of what's going on. So I would say that, you know, kind of wanting to bear witness and kind of accompany people through these difficult moments is really what drew me to psychology. And then it was in probably graduate school that I started to focus more, or even going into graduate school when I knew that not only did I want to study psychology, but I wanted to have my career be focused on psychology, that I started really thinking about food and body issues, you know, at that time, again, framed very much in this weight management context.
Yeah. And so you, your first career in psychology, or your first sort of research position, at least, was in quote unquote obesity research. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to do that work and what that was like?
Yeah. So in graduate school, like I said, I went in really being very interested around people's relationship with food. I was seeing it through the only framework that I knew how to see that through, which was this lens of kind of overeating and weight management. But having struggled so much around my own relationship with food, having that be such a big part of my family life at home as well, it was something that I was so yearning to better understand. And in graduate school, I started working in a research lab that was looking at obesity research, specifically around bariatric surgery. That's what I was really interested in, to understand for people who, of course, at the time, I assumed that everyone who had bariatric surgery, you know, must be struggling with their relationship with food in some way, because of course, how else would you be in a bigger body? That was my understanding, you know, from this very diet culture, fat phobic lens. But I got really interested in kind of understanding psychologically what happens to people as they undergo bariatric surgery. That's what my dissertation was about, looking at substance use in people who undergo bariatric surgery. Is actually one of the first studies to find an increased risk of alcohol use in people following gastric bypass surgery. And from there, I really was primed to enter this career in obesity research and weight management. So in my postdoctoral work, I worked in a bariatric surgery center and also continued working in obesity research. And I did that for many years.
I'm curious to talk a little bit about that bariatric surgery research. Like, what do you think that increased risk of alcohol use, which we now see replicated in multiple studies, what do you think that's about for people who've had bariatric surgery?
It's interesting, you know, when you look at it, a lot of the research really points to that it's specific to certain types of bariatric surgery. And there is some thought that there are changes in the wiring of the reward mechanisms in your brain after you have bariatric surgery that can make you more primed to develop issues around substance use. Multiple studies have replicated the risk of alcohol use after bariatric surgery, but also they're starting to see issues with opiate abuse and I think some other drug abuse as well. Interestingly, also the way that because bariatric surgery, especially gastric bypass surgery, alters the functioning and the mechanisms of your digestive system, it changes the way that you absorb food and alcohol and other drugs as well, and can actually, it speeds up the absorption. So there is some thought that it has to do with, you know, the alcohol is being absorbed very quickly into your bloodstream, making you feel more intoxicated with less alcohol more quickly. And your brain is also primed for that to be more rewarding, which can be a little bit of a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, for sure. And that idea that things are absorbed more quickly is common to a lot of the side effects of bariatric surgery, right? As I understand it, like the dumping syndrome being that, you know, things are absorbed really quickly into the gut and you kind of can't handle all of that carbohydrate or whatever it is being absorbed at once. And so diarrhea is the result. Seems like multiple things that result from that sort of quick absorption in bariatric surgery.
Yes, as well as a lot of the vitamin deficiencies and malnutrition issues that we see in people after surgery.
What are some of the other mental health effects of bariatric surgery that you found?
About 5 to 7 years out after surgery is where we start seeing a lot of the negative psychological complications following surgery. And one of those risks that we do see is an increased risk of suicide.
That's really important to know. And I think bariatric surgery is one of those things that's presented in a way that sort of minimizes the risk. And I see that a lot across the diet and pharmaceutical weight loss industry. It's like the actual risks of interventions are maybe downplayed or not presented at all in some cases, or if they are presented, it's sort of like, but the, you know, the quote unquote risk outweighs the benefit. And, you know, the risks of staying a higher weight are worth taking on all these potential risks of physical and mental health complications. And I think it's so insidious because it doesn't, it's not really a fair comparison, I think, you know, in that weight stigma is associated with and is a risk factor for all of these conditions that get blamed on weight itself and may perhaps explain, along with weight cycling and disordered eating and other issues that higher weight people are more likely to face, like may explain a lot of that difference in risk for chronic health conditions and mortality in people who are higher weight. But it sort of gets painted, of course, in diet culture as causation, as like higher weight causes all these things, and therefore you're at risk staying higher weight, and it's worth taking on all these sometimes pretty extreme risks, even if they're relatively unlikely to happen. But, you know, things like an increased risk of suicide or an increased risk of alcohol use disorder or other substance use disorders, it's not something that, you know, many people would take lightly, I think, if they really thought about the risk-benefit analysis.
Exactly. And I think that we're seeing a similar conversation coming up around the GLP-1 medications. And, you know, I think that it's this idea that, you know, weight loss at any cost, you know, that the most important thing is to lose weight, and that's always going to improve your health, even if there are really serious health risks and complications to taking these medications or having surgery. And people may not be in poor health to begin with, right? The assumption that everyone who's in a larger body must obviously, you know, be, you know, on death's doorstep is we know that so clearly from research is not accurate. So, you know, I think that's definitely something that we're seeing. And I know certainly with bariatric surgery, I agree there's a huge minimization of the risks of surgery. And I think even when we look at, for example, the risk of death, this is an area that I've been interested in and really want to dive in on the research, but I haven't had the time to do it. But the standard for something being classified as a death related to bariatric surgery, mortality as a complication for bariatric surgery, is only recorded, I believe, if it happens in the first 30 days after surgery. And the responsibility is on the surgeons to record that and report it, and they report it to the Bariatric Surgery Association. So the Bariatric Surgery Association is the holder of all of that mortality risk of surgery. And, you know, most people don't die on the table when they're having bariatric surgery. They have complications, you know, they kind of go in and out of the hospital for some time. And if they, you know, sadly do die, it's typically not within the first 30 days, but very much is related to the fact that they had bariatric surgery, and none of that is captured.
Wow. Yeah, that is really insidious and shows so much of like the profit motive at play and how that can make otherwise ethical providers perhaps not report the things that need to be reported.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think that we need independent oversight with all of these things.
Right. And I'm so curious, like, how that would play out.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
I'm also curious to hear about your experience working in quote unquote obesity research and that whole field. And there's a connection for sure to be made to the conversation that's happening now about GLP-1s and, you know, the medicalization of higher body weight and all of that. So I'd love to go back in time to when you started working that field. And as you got further into that research too, like what you came to understand about both the research underlying weight loss recommendations and like how industry played a role in creating and disseminating information about weight loss.
Yeah, so that was one of the things that was really eye-opening to me as I spent time in the quote-unquote obesity research and the obesity industry, was that intermingling of money from companies that have very clear motives to be, you know, incentivizing weight loss and kind of the medical recommendations that were passed down to doctors and the research that was being carried out. So, you know, one example that I'll share, well, I have two examples that I'm thinking of, but, you know, one was a nonprofit organization that appeared to be fighting against weight stigma. But when you look into it, it was very clearly funded by the Bariatric Surgery Association, as well as kind of an obesity organization. And it was, the whole idea was to create this group that seemed like a patient advocacy group, but was actually advocating for the alleviation of weight stigma so that patients would feel comfortable going to their doctor so that they could be recommended weight loss and bariatric surgery and not feel stigmatized about engaging in those surgeries. And, you know, they framed insurance companies not covering those surgeries as quote unquote weight stigma, and spent a lot of money like lobbying Washington to get insurance coverage for bariatric surgery. But this was all done under the guise, you know, if you looked at this organization on face value, you would not know that it was connected to the Bariatric Surgery Association. So that was like one place that I saw it. And then another thing that comes to mind is just, I was involved in that world when I think it was in 2013, when the American Medical Association decided to classify obesity as a disease. And as many of us in the kind of anti-diet world know, that was a controversial decision made by the AMA. They had put together an independent advisory council to research the topic and come up with recommendations. Their recommendation was actually not to classify obesity as a disease. And what was at the time a very rare decision, the AMA went against the advice of the advisory council and decided to classify it as a disease anyway. And it was interesting timing because it was the first time that there were two new weight loss medications that were being FDA approved coming into the pipeline, entering the market. And the decision to have obesity classified as a disease meant that these medications would now be eligible for insurance reimbursement. So they would be far more profitable. So I don't think the timing of that was coincidental. And I will always remember being at one of these obesity conferences and having the president or someone kind of in administration for the organization get up on stage and very openly said that they wanted that, you know, everyone was kind of celebrating this decision from the AMA to classify obesity as a disease. And they got up and said, you know, we want to thank our friends at the Endocrinology Association because for obvious reasons, we couldn't be behind the lobbying efforts to get the obesity classified as a disease to the AMA. So we had our friends at the Endocrinology Association lobby on our behalf because it was less, the financial interest was less obvious coming through the Endocrinology Association than coming through the Bariatric Surgery Association.
Ugh, that is so nefarious. And so it just really shows how much intent goes into these decisions, you know, like how much wheeling and dealing goes on behind the scenes to try to get these things done and pushed through. And it's incredibly unethical. And yet there's no oversight to that. And especially when they can kind of pass it off to their friends in endocrinology, where it doesn't necessarily look like as much of a conflict of interest, even though there is rampant weight stigma and pharmaceutical industry money going into endocrinologists' pockets to push for these quote unquote treatments, you know, surgery and medication, diet, drugs, and all that stuff. It just seems like there's no real oversight of those kinds of decisions, you know?
Yeah, I think there's no oversight, and it's all very normalized and accepted within the industry. You know, again, that comment that I heard was not made at some high level, you know, small group closed door meeting. It was to the general conference at the president's address.
Yeah, so it's not like they're trying to hide it. It's not secret. I mean, I've noticed that in some of the conversations around these new weight loss drugs as well, where like in the Oprah special, which aired recently, it's at the time we're talking, she has two people on who are paid consultants to Novo Nordisk, which makes, you know, Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 weight loss drugs. And, you know, these paid consultants are going on about the benefits of these drugs and, you know, why obesity is a disease and all of this stuff. And then there's one little moment where she's like, you know, you're both paid consultants to Novo Nordisk. Why is that? Or something. Or like, what does that mean? I think she says, what does that mean? And then one of them says, it means that, you know, they see my expert opinion as valuable or something, just ridiculous. And then the other one says, it means that, you know, I've gotten consulting money from them to do, you know, continuing education talks. And I've also taken money from them to do some research on upcoming obesity medications or something. And then Oprah's like, okay, cool. When we come back, we're going to talk to someone else about something totally different. It's like, that's it, you know? And when I see any of these disclosures happening in newspapers or other media outlets, there is often, not always, like very rarely, actually, I think, as compared to the volume of coverage about these drugs, but there is occasionally a nod to like, you know, this person is a paid consultant to Novo Nordisk or to Eli Lilly or to someone else who makes weight loss drugs, as is common practice in the field among obesity experts, you know? And it's like, that's considered sort of all they have to say. And then they move on. And there's no real effort to dig into like, why is that so normalized in the field? Why is it considered okay? Why is it not a massive conflict of interest, which I think it is. And, you know, I think you probably agree. Many people listening to this will probably agree. Why is that sort of conflict not discussed more and sort of shown a light on in, you know, popular press? And why is there no real investigative journalism going on in this country? There is some in the UK. The Guardian and Observer did a series on pharmaceutical industry influence around the adoption of those drugs to the UK formulary. And I think that was really interesting. But, you know, here there's just not a real effort to do investigative reporting. Even when I've talked to journalists and sort of pointed them in that direction, it doesn't seem like anybody really wants to follow that up.
I agree. I think that it's too normalized. And I think that even, you know, the fact that some of these specials, the Oprah one, which I haven't watched yet, but there was also a similar one, I think last year by 60 Minutes, where all the medical experts were paid consultants for Novo Nordisk. And why aren't we finding independent experts instead of the people that the drug companies are saying, here, talk to this person. This person obviously has a specific agenda to promote. And it just kind of blows my mind that why aren't we finding people that don't have a conflict of interest? There's many, many doctors out there.
Right. And why is it so normalized in the field that these people can have a talking point of like, oh, that's just how it's done in our field. That's just, you know, if you talk to any, and it's pretty true too. Like if you find anyone who's a significant quote unquote expert in obesity, they're likely going to be on some consulting panel somewhere or have done continuing education work for a pharmaceutical company. And, you know, sometimes it's also like Weight Watchers International or Jenny Craig or whatever. There's some sort of financial tie, you know, in their history. And I just think it's really important to like dig into why that's happening, and nobody seems to be in that industry. Do you have a sense of why, like when you were in that field, what was sort of the discourse around industry relationships that you heard?
I think that by and large, it was very normalized. There were certainly researchers and people that I worked with who were opposed to taking any kind of industry money. But, you know, to be frank, I think it's very appealing because being a researcher is not an easy way to make a living. And I think that, you know, I think a lot of people need the money, to be frank, is what the motivation is. And you know, I think it gets into all kinds of issues around the value that we put as a society on medical research, you know, the average person doing medical research, putting aside people who are, you know, discovering like a new pharmaceutical or a new device or something where you can make a lot of money. You know, you're reliant on grant money. It's there's an instability in some of that profession. And if, you know, I think a lot of people do feel just from a capitalistic perspective that if they can, you know, have a stable position working with pharmaceuticals or industry and get a, you know, kind of fat paycheck from them, it's appealing.
I mean, I get that as a dietitian in private practice and an author and journalist, like independently, you know, freelance sometimes for some publications and I have my own stuff. Like it's a tough way to make a living and it's kind of up and down and it's not super stable. And when you have a family, that's not great, you know? And like, I can totally see why people do that. And I sometimes wish I didn't have, I feel like I've painted myself into a corner in a way of being so critical of industry relationships for everyone else that I'm like, well, I can't do that now. But part of me wishes I could. Part of me wishes I had that option because it would be nice to have more money, you know?
Yeah. So I think that's a lot of the motivation for people. You know, I don't think it's necessary. Like, I don't think the average doctor or researcher is nefarious in, you know, trying to carry out some diabolical plot. I think most people are just day to day, like trying to get by.
Yeah. And it sort of is like a systemic issue, actually, this lack of stability in capitalism in general for most workers and with researchers specifically being so dependent on grant money. I can see why it's appealing to have something that's a little bit of more of a stable source of income.
I'm also really taken a lot of the times by how hidden the disclosures are. I'm just thinking as we're talking about an article I read recently that was talking about that weight management programs do not increase the risk of eating disorders and actually can help treat eating disorders. And I'm like, wow, what an interesting article that really goes against like everything that's common knowledge in the field of eating disorders. And I was reading through the article and it wasn't until I read through the entire, it was maybe a 10 or 12 page article, I read through the entire article that I get to a little sentence at the end that I only saw because I was looking to copy the citation for something because it was like hidden in the addendum that said this researcher is a consultant for Novo Nordisk, and this other researcher is a consultant for Weight Watchers, and this other person for Slimming World. I mean, I think that there has to be a way for people to be aware, because that obviously would impact the way that I was reading the article in the first place, and to not even have that knowledge until afterwards is kind of problematic.
Right, right. Yeah, you were not reading it with the sort of critical eye that, or the distance that you might have been with that knowledge ahead of time. For someone to go through the entire article and get to that tiny disclosure at the bottom takes like a access to the full article, which I think journalists and other people who cover nutrition and health and weight and all that stuff don't have access to or don't have time to read the whole article and maybe don't have the knowledge and the training. I've talked about this a lot on both podcasts about how like going into my career as a journalist, I was coming out of a undergraduate degree in rhetoric and French literature. Like I did not have the training on how to read a scientific study. I sort of learned on the job, but I didn't get a complete understanding of how to do that until I went to graduate school. And you know, mostly I was reporting based on a press release, an abstract, and then some conversations with an expert, you know, quote unquote expert who was like the researcher, or one of the researchers affiliated with the study, or maybe another researcher who was not affiliated with the study to give a counterpoint or whatever it was, you know? And I think that's what a lot of journalists and reporters do, you know? It's like they're not looking in depth and combing through the disclosures and the fine print to see what sort of influence is there and how that might affect how their source is reporting and what sort of other sources they might want to get to have a balanced perspective or some critical input. So what gets disseminated in the media, you know, whether it's about eating disorders and weight management or about these new diet drugs or about weight loss and nutrition and health in general, I think is so skewed and so biased. And it's really tricky. And it's tough to have these conversations because I'm aware from my reporting for my second book, The Wellness Trap, that there's like a whole anti-vaccine industry. And to a certain extent, the wellness industry more generally, that relies on this narrative about the corrupt pharmaceutical industry and the corrupt conventional medical industry and how, you know, you can't trust doctors and they're just out to get you for profit and, you know, they don't care about the public health. And so come over here to the anti-vax movement or come over here to the wellness industry where we care about you and we'll help you and we'll do everything quote unquote naturally and like trust us. And then they're selling you snake oil. So I think it's important to have nuance in these conversations and sort of not let yourself get like conspiratorial and you're thinking about the entire healthcare system and the entire pharmaceutical industry, even though there are these pockets of real problems and real ways that the bias influences the research and the reporting on the research that is very skewed towards the interests of industry.
I couldn't agree more. I think it can be a slippery slope and it can be hard to understand what to believe. But I think that in research, we look for, you know, replicability. So, you know, when we start to see results over and over again, it starts to speak to something. And I think that it's important to be critical when we're looking at research. It's important to be critical when you are interfacing with doctors or understanding medical guidelines or recommendations that healthcare professionals might make. And it's also important not to throw away the entire paradigm and to understand, you know, I think that most doctors are truly in it to try to help people. They're doing this because they care. And, you know, I think that when we can kind of try to parse out the, you know, this is one of the reasons that I think it's so important that disclosures be made more prominent and that we're able to understand, you know, how industry influences recommendations and research, because otherwise it does create kind of a more widespread mistrust when I think it is kind of the pockets that we have to be cautious about.
I know. I wish there was more science education in schools, like from teaching people from a young age how to understand influence and look for signs of, you know, that something maybe is not, you don't necessarily have to throw away the results entirely, but you could see it as this is an outlier based on, you know, that may be influenced by this special interest that is behind the financing of it or, you know, the authors that are writing this research or whatever.
Exactly. And I think so many of us are getting lots of our health information from social media, which is somewhere where all nuance is lost. So we're kind of only taking in the most extreme perspectives.
Totally. Yeah. And that's what the incentives of the algorithms do, is it actually incentivizes extreme perspectives and things that provoke moral outrage and misinformation and like all of that. Does well from the algorithm's perspective of keeping people engaged and keeping people on the platforms getting served more ads. So it doesn't, you know, behoove the social media companies necessarily to change those algorithms in favor of helping us have more nuanced conversations. And, you know, the kinds of things that really sell are the controversial takes, unfortunately.
Yes, exactly. You know, I think that we see the most extreme viewpoints and they're presented to us as if everyone feels this way. And I think it can be really hard to digest and to understand that, like, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Right. Well, I mean, I will say, as someone who wrote a book called Anti-Diet and who's part of an anti-diet movement and was for a while, you know, earlier in my career, very strident about these sorts of things, I do feel like I was pushed in a more nuance-free kind of direction by the incentives of social media. And like, you know, I started to write in ways that just like stripped out some of the qualifying language and the uncertainty of it all. And like, was, you know, writing from a place of sort of black and white certainty sometimes. And that's not really who I am. And I think I got pushed there by the pressures of social media and this sort of media environment more generally. And now I'm trying to think through like how to continue to have anti-diet values in the sense that I don't promote diet culture and I want to help people think critically about diet and wellness culture and not succumb to all these false promises and the harms that can be associated with that. And I also want to speak with more nuance and think in a less black and white sort of way about all of these things. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that coming from a similar place. I mean, we'll talk in a minute about like how you got to the anti-diet perspective in the first place, but just since we're on this topic of like social media nuance, I'm curious if you've had any sort of thinking around this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say same.
That was the first half of my interview with Alexis Connison. There's lots more to come, and it's really juicy. We get into the issues with social media, Ozempic and other GLP-1 drugs, and the problems with the research underlying weight loss recommendations. To hear it all, become a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com or click the link in the show notes. In the meantime, you can find Alexis and learn more about her work at drconason.com. That's drconason.com or on social media at The Anti-Diet Plan. Thanks so much to her for coming on the show. I really, really love this conversation. If you like this episode, I'd love for you to subscribe or follow Rethinking Wellness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thanks for being here, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care.